Well, where do you go for health advice? Your parents? Next, maybe your GP, the chemist perhaps, your best friend. I'm not sure that I'd be compelled to go back to the very hospital I was born in for answers to my health questions, but surreally that's what it looks like we're about to do, because the Royal Women's Hospital in Melbourne has put together a book so big that you will find a health problem to address in it, even if you think you don't have any. It's called the Women's Health Book. It's quite a tome, and we're going to use it as a launch pad for a new series on women's health over coming weeks on Thursdays. The Royal Women's is Australia's largest hospital dedicated to the health of women of all ages. Sue Matthews is its chief executive. Welcome, Sue.
Thank you. Good morning.
And Annette Dobson is joining us too this morning. She's a professor of biostatistics in the School of Population Health at the University of Queensland. She's director of a fantastic study called the Australian Longitudinal Study on Women's Health. That's a project that's been running since 96. Welcome, Annette.
Morning, Natasha.
Good to have you on the show. Sue, big yes. Fat book. You've got a bit of an agenda here, don't you?
Definitely. The women's is the largest hospital, as you said, a specialist women's hospital, and our mandate is to improve the health of women, you know, particularly in Victoria, but across all of Australia.
Yes, but it's more complicated than that, isn't it? Because what's interesting here is that women's health has been informed by research that only focused on the male of the species. Tell us how.
So generally, most participants in medical research are men. So only one third of participants in medical research are women. Studies are designed around men, they're carried out on men, and then their results are extrapolated to women, which does not necessarily equate to women's health.
Mm. Now, this is not just about men, it's also about male lab rats as well. I mean, right.
Yes.
Back to the basics. In all... most medical research, male lab rats, for example, or lab animals were considered much less complicated because they didn't have that sort of estrus cycle to complicate mm-hmm. results.
Mm-hmm, exactly. And that's one of the things. The Royal Women's obviously does a vast amount of research on women, but we are one small piece of the research cog, although we do a large amount of research. But on animals, on people, women are seen as more complicated, as you say, and thus they want to do the research on something that isn't as complicated. But that then doesn't work when they try to take the results of those and apply them to women.
Yeah, male becomes generic human. Now, what are the potential implications of this? Because, in fact, they can be quite serious. There are a couple of big black holes.
Definitely. There are lots of things. An example is for heart attacks, for example. A woman who has a heart attack will often have different signs and symptoms than a man will have. And they tend to not get treated as quickly because their symptoms are different. The research studies have been done on men as a vast majority, although there are some up and coming on women. And so the treatment has been male-focused, and they haven't caught heart attacks necessarily as quickly until recently in women because they hadn't done the studies on women.
Yes, and we might pick up on that throughout this series. In the book, there's a great conversation, and we're getting to that, we're touching on that there are gender differences and there are sex differences. What's the distinction you're making there?
Well, gender is about social aspects as well as not just the physical aspects. So while you are a woman by sex, you have, you know, ovaries and uterus, etc. That's the sex part. So it's more pathophysiological than it is social. And the women's has a social approach to health as well, because there are many things that are social factors for women that impact their health that we need to determine and understand and be able to treat. An example in adolescence is body image. So bullying, those sorts of things impact a young woman's body image, which then impacts their ability to be healthy.
Mm. And if we look at the sex differences, those biological differences, at the heart of that, is it women's hormones that are the defining distinction there?
Definitely. There are different hormones. You know, obviously we have a different type of organs than men do, but the hormonal cycle is very impacted by, for our health, impacts our health quite a bit.
And in all different facets of our health too. I think we don't fully appreciate how those hormones tap into so many different aspects of our health and well-being.
Definitely, yes.
Mm-hmm. Let me come to Annette Dobson, Director of the Australian Longitudinal Study on Women's Health. Bet you love rolling that off the tongue every day.
it's a bit of a mouthful.
Now, this is a very powerful study, potentially, tracking across three generations. Tell us how it works.
Okay, it's actually four generations now. Yes, we now have over 50,000 women right across Australia who are participating in the study. For the first group, who were recruited in 1996, they've been doing surveys at least every 3 years since then. So this is a study actually embedded in the sort of feminist thinking of the early and mid-90s, when there was this strong feeling that the health system was designed by men for men. I don't think that's necessarily true.
No, and many men would think, well, no, hang on, I don't feel like that.
That's right. In fact, the
I'm
men
not getting
may,
my needs met either.
That's right. They may actually be even more alienated from the system. However, that's sort of a different story. Mm. Anyway, that was the genesis of the study. It's funded by the Australian Department of what's now the Department of Health. So it's about health services. In particular, what are the health services that women need? What are the barriers to access? What is their satisfaction with the services? So it means you also have to know about what the health is to figure out what they need. Mm. But that's the basis of it. So it provides fairly high-level evidence at the federal level to the sorts of services needed and what works and what doesn't work.
So in tracking those four generations of women, when you get them to sit down and do those regular surveys, what are you asking them about? And are they very particular questions for each age group?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Oh, the newest cohort, we only just recruited in 2012 because nobody actually knew what was happening about the youngest women, aged, you know, from about 18 to early 20s.
Yeah.
There was very little is known about that in Australia, and so we were commissioned to recruit a new cohort.
So pull them in as well. Yeah.
Yes. So the issues are all the common conditions and symptoms and signs and so on, and whether they go to a GP and whether they bother to have something treated or not. There's the key issues around weight and body image and body shape. There's all the mental health issues, not just diagnosed conditions of clinical depression, but you know, general distress and stress is one of the most common words that comes up.
Affecting women of all ages, and
absolutely,
quite notably so.
Yes, indeed.
Mm.
But interestingly, for mental health, for the sort of general mental health levels that you get in the community as opposed to clinical groups, mental health actually improves as you get older.
Well,
the people are really stressed to these poor 18 to 20-year-olds.
Yeah, which is is encouraging that you've brought them into the study. But are there other particular things that you're looking at in different age groups?
Yeah, I mean, obviously for the group who were originally in their mid-40s, we collected a lot of data on menopause and the long-term symptom continuation following menopause. So we've done a lot of work on menopause. For the right across all the groups, we've looked at domestic violence and the mental health and sometimes physical health impact of that, which can be over a lifetime. And then there are a lot of social factors. Obviously, widowhood is a huge issue for the oldest women, and now very, very few of them are still married. They're now in their 80s.
What sort of questions are you asking that are about health in relation to becoming a widow?
The questions are not sort of in relation to. So we ask about widowhood, and then separately we have questions about mental health and social connectedness and so on.
Mm.
And so what you get is often So remember, before they become widowed, they may well have been carers for sick husbands, and the stress levels at that stage are awful. And then immediately around the time of widowhood, there's obviously a lot of mental and physical issues, but there's also a lot of social support comes in then. And then as they move away from widowhood, go past widowhood, they reorganize their lives, the mental health improves, but in fact social things might actually drop off a bit.
Yes. Sue Matthews, CEO of the Royal Women's Hospital in Melbourne. One of the issues that comes up in this guide, the Women's Health book that you've put together, that is the launchpad for our series over the coming next few weeks, is that relationship with the GP. Now, you will know as well as I that a lot of women don't have one regular doctor. They might go to bulk bill clinics and they'll see whoever they can get, or they might move house, their lives might change. But that's a relationship that you really do zero in on, isn't it?
Yes, it's very important for your primary healthcare provider to know you as a person, and this speaks to the social aspects as well. They need to not only understand the episode, whatever that episode is that you are going to a doctor for, but they need to understand the journey of you as a human being and what it is that you have dealt with psychologically, emotionally, physically, and spiritually.
So there are tables listing tests and checks, mm-hmm. conversations that you should have with your GP about very specific issues. I was overwhelmed at page 5, I think. By about page 30, I went, oh, my God. Are you scaring us?
No. Actually, the book is about staying well. Mm. It's not about dealing with an illness that anyone may get across their lifespan. So in order to stay well, it's about empowering the woman to have the understanding and knowledge, because knowledge is power, to be able to care for their own health and to be able to, in partnership with their primary care provider, their physician, some have nurse practitioners, but with their primary care provider, to care for themselves so that they are empowered to make their own decisions. One of the things we find with women is they tend to take care of everyone else before themselves, and sometimes to the exclusion of themselves. And so this is about giving them the knowledge of what they should know and what they should be asking, and how they, once they understand that, they take better care of themselves.
So what sorts of particular, and again, this series is about covering some of these, so we won't get to everything today, of course, but what particular conversations would you like to see women having with their doctors about particular issues?
I think it's important to talk about domestic violence, to talk about your mental health. Are you depressed? Are you socially isolated? You know, at that, as we talked earlier about the women at the widowhood stage, these are things that come into play. Your financial situation, because that is a huge impact on your health, your living situation, who do you live with? All of those things are part of the health aspects, not just the signs and symptoms of something that you think is wrong with you. That's what we're trying to empower women to know.
Now, that's great, and women might want to have those conversations and might get the courage to initiate those conversations with their doctors. Mm-hmm. Are doctors always willing to hear that kind of full complexity? And even if they're willing, do they have the time to hear that?
I'm not a physician, so I obviously won't speak on behalf of physicians, but the majority of physicians do know that this is part of the life of a person. The majority of physicians go into medicine to make a difference in people's lives. And so, yes, they do know this. Do they have the time? I think when someone is raising an issue, it takes much less time to deal with it up front and address it than it does to let it get to a point where there becomes a chronic illness or there becomes an issue, because then they end up spending much more time with that patient in the long run.
Mm. What's really powerful about what you're saying is that issues like domestic violence, experiences like that, are health issues. You know, they are fundamentally health issues. Now, so smoking. And I have to say that early on in the book too, there are two headings, don't smoke, and a few pages on, don't smoke.
Exactly.
Now, women smoke.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So what are you trying to convey when you're saying don't do it.
You know, I think many, many people understand, you know, what they should and shouldn't do. There are many people who are overweight. I'm overweight. Do I exercise enough? All of those things that, you know what you should do and what you shouldn't do, but you cannot know it enough. And, you know, communication is number one. The more times you tell people don't smoke, that one extra time might be the time that they say, I really need to do something about this and stop smoking.
Mm. Annette Dobson, there at the Australian Longitudinal Study on Women's Health. I think back in 2002, you released a significant report that assessed how women were going with adhering to health guidelines on things like smoking, alcohol, nutrition. What did you find?
The smoking story is really good. Smoking is going down in all age groups. In the new cohort that we've just recruited, the smoking is lower than it was in women of the same age in 1996. Smoking story is a good story. Certainly it needs to go down to zero, but it's certainly improving.
What about grog?
Look, the guidelines change more often than women's habits, I think. It's very difficult. And similarly, dietary guidelines are very poorly understood and rather poorly communicated, actually. But the biggest issue of all is weight gain. This is a huge problem. Normalizing overweight, and we're seeing this particularly in the women who are now in their 30s and in the young women in their early 20s. Those young women are now 4 kilos heavier than the women who were at the same age in 1996.
Gee.
The 30-year-olds are gaining, on average, 600 grams a year, and that just piles on and on. And we've looked a lot at the triggers for that, but this is by far the biggest health problem. We've got to unnormalize. It's a terrible word.
Well, it has been normalized because the fashion industry shifts and suddenly size 14 isn't size 14 that it used to be. What are some of the, just in the last minute that we have, what are some of the key triggers that concern you?
Oh, well, we know women start it's about eating more rather than just the exercise, eating balance. We do know that when women move into relationships, get married, settle down with a bloke, the eating habits of both change. That's the biggest risk of weight gain, actually more than having babies.
Yes, and it has implications for heart disease risk down the track, and I hope that we consider that in the series as we flagged earlier in the program.
Indeed.
Yeah. Oh, look, terrific to have you both kick off this series with us. Sue Matthews, CEO of the Royal Women's Hospital in Melbourne, the place I was born, in fact. Thanks for joining us.
You're welcome. Thank you for inviting me.
And Annette Dobson, also Director of the Australian Longitudinal Study on Women's Health. Love to hear more about the study over time as well. Thanks very much, Annette.
Thank you, Natasha.
And Annette is a professor at the University of Queensland. So tune in every Thursday, Women's Health Series, coming your way here on Life Matters.